Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, hello and welcome to Food for Thought, a podcast gap this friend, a multiracial mix of queer writers gather around the table to talk about sex, identity, culture. What we like to read and who we like to read. Food for thought. Get in, losers. We're getting fisted.
Oh, my God.
Woo, we went right there this episode. We went right there.
I refuse.
I've never seen the appeal of it personally, but, like, Joe, you're a pro, right?
I feel like it's one of those things that in theory should not be fun, but then you realize when someone's about 4.5 fingers in and you're like, let's just go for it. You're like,
it is sometimes like an accidental fisting.
I almost, you're all so big.
I almost spit out my throat coat tea. Accidental fisting. That is my new band name.
Accidental fisting.
I am the lead singer.
That should be your new Twitter name when your book comes out. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Wow. No. Ooh. Never. Never. Ever. Ever.
Really, Tia? I feel like you would be into it.
You know, it's when I do think about it, it actually the idea feels kind of hot. But I just think I think I would black out.
I'm really worried about permanent butthole damage, which I think a lot of people in the fisting community are kind of resolved to. It's like it kind of comes with the territory that your butthole could potentially be permanently loosened.
The butthole is a very resilient and plastic orifice. It bounces back from a lot. I mean, there are definitely, you know, there's Rosebud Twitter, and I don't mean Bernie Sanders Rosebud Twitter. I mean gay Rosebud Twitter.
That, I don't like it. That I don't is like it at all.
It is a lot. It is not like, I don't find it hot. I'm glad other people do. But yeah, I mean, there are folks for whom like body modification of their hole through fisting is like a part of their sex life.
Yeah.
And then there's those of us who just enjoy it from time to time.
From time to time.
From time to time.
As time goes by.
Anyways, glad we started off here.
Hi, I'm Tommy Teebs Pico, Indigenous American poet, screenwriter, TV writer, and I am really, really enjoying my time off. I have never had this good of a relationship to rest and relaxation. I'm just like, but you know what the other thing is? Like, time off hits different when you have a little money.
when you're not poverty.
Right. Everything actually is
poverty.
Wow.
I am Joseph Osmondson, scientist, nonfiction writer, and just like COVID, my clinical depression is back.
Aww.
Yay.
Poor thing. Poor no.
I'm Fran. I'm a writer. I'm an editor. And I dedicate this third thing to my childhood crush, Lindsay Lohan, in honor of today's early aughts episode.
Wow. I used to run
around my high school and tell people that I was madly in love with Lindsay Lohan.
I believe that you did it.
I don't believe that you believed it, if that makes sense.
And of course, I bought all of Lindsay Lohan's albums and all of the soundtracks of the movies she was in, because when you have a crush on someone, that's what you do, right?
Mm. Yeah. Mm. It reminds me of like listening to Les Culturistas and Matt Rogers talk about how he used to tell people he had a crush on Kelly Clarkson.
have you seen, there's this amazing comedian, Joe Castlebaker, that does this like impression of like a kid who's pretending to have a crush, and he's like, yeah, I just love her hair. I love her long brown hair, so brown, so long, love her hair, really pretty hair.
Oh my God. Wow. Well, on that note, I am Den Michelle Norris, and I'm a reader and writer, former figure skater, and my early aughts crushes were Beyonce from Destiny's Child and Christina Aguilera.
Fair.
That's exactly how I said it, too.
Like the stripped era Christina?
The stripped era Christina, yeah.
That was a good vintage of Christina.
It was.
It was a very solid Christina.
Yeah. I love that she was just so shameless. I was like, okay, I'm here for this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Fighter, that was my junior year anthem. That was the song. That was everything to me.
Well, who's got the menu today?
I got the menu today. It's an episode all about a time that I cannot believe is like 20 fucking years ago. We're talking
Stop
about a decade.
That.
We're talking about the aughts, the music, the culture, who we were personally, who we were collectively. We start out with the swipe left on all of the pop culture of that era, and we end with one delicious bite.
Ew. I'm feeling a little peckish. I think we should start the top of the show the way any good top should, with a little tease, our uproarious appetizer segment, Amuse Bouche. And I believe Fran is amusing our bouche with his little cornichon.
Frangela!
That's right. We have a delicious little early aughts themed swipe right, swipe left. And to start us off, dear thoughts, swipe right or swipe left on... The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen.
I love The Corrections, actually. And it is like...
What is it even about?
It is sort of like a... It's a bridge, I would say, between experimental fiction of the 80s, where there's a premise... I know. There's a premise that there's a pill that older folks in the book can take to get rid of their fear of death. There is so it's like it's the family. The parents and the family go on a cruise. The dad is getting really bad dementia. Actually, the scenes written from the point of view of the dad's dementia are disorienting and weird and lovely. And there's a lesbian chef character who's sort of like throwing her life away. And then there's like a straight male protagonist who's also like throwing his life away in different ways, and they're sort of dealing with their parents getting older, with their relationship to each other, and with like the personal financial collapse that they're both kind of going with in the middle of their life. It's a lovely, there's queerness in it is sort of destabilizing and good, and all of his books afterwards pale in comparison.
Well, I am swiping left specifically because I was sitting at my pool the other day, you know, just minding my own business in 95 degree weather, trying to read a book as I do. And some other guy walked up to me and he goes, "Oh, what you reading?" Which is like the most annoying thing for any person to do. If I'm reading, don't ask me what I'm reading because I'm busy reading. And then this man proceeded to recommend to me Jonathan Franzen, and he said, and he was like, and I'm like, girl, I'm reading a book about like, you know, like gender theory, like fuck off, like I don't want this.
I will also swipe right on The Corrections.
Yeah. Wait, you're swiping right?
I know. Actually, Joe actually recommended the book to me. No.
On brand.
Spreading that heterosexual nonsense. But I mean, because I'm like working on a pilot about medication, and it was actually quite informative.
Ooh, you should.
Go.
I was just going to say, you should watch Severance on Apple TV. Have you watched?
I have not.
The premise that Joe described actually reminded me of it. I just finished it last night. It's a show on Apple TV about basically a surgical procedure where you can separate your work life from your personal life.
Oh,
it's
my like, God.
It's basically kind of a lobotomy that bifurcates your personality. And it's phenomenal. You should watch. Didn't mean to interrupt.
Okay. That.
Just going to say that I actually have been debating. I was like really excited to watch that show until I realized that it's not inspired by Ling Ma's novel Severance, and now I'm not interested.
Yes, it's completely different.
It's completely different. But I will also be, and Joe, I'm so glad you brought this up, because I'm going to be delivering the definitive swipe left that Oprah should have delivered on this book in the first place and didn't. So we are swiping left on The Corrections. We have no time for Jonathan Franzen, who cannot
right
imagine...
I'll swipe right on Severance by Ling Ma, but like that was a hell of a book to read at the beginning of the pandemic.
Listen, that timing.
It doesn't count. It's not from the early aughts. Anyways, swipe right, swipe left, Britney Spears' Blackout album.
Oh, Swipe right so
swipe
hard.
Right.
Ahead of its so time.
Actually completely genius and totally ahead of its time.
Truly, yeah. Truly.
Just a brilliant, brilliant, comeback. Brilliant album.
Yeah. I would swipe right, but I would swipe righter on The Emancipation of Mimi by Mariah Carey, because that was a comeback for the early aughts ages.
Babe, yes. That is such a good reference point.
That's such such an important
Are we swiping right, swiping left on Britney Spears being pregnant right now?
not the crickets. Not the awkward Zoom crickets.
I know. Are we happy that Britney has a baby one more time?
Oh, God. Wow. I'm happy about that pun you just made.
Come on. Come on. I think we all collectively have swiped right on her thick ass boyfriend. Her giant meatball ass, like Greek statue of a boyfriend and baby daddy, I guess.
Absolutely.
Have I not seen this person?
No, Teebs, we've definitely talked in the chat about him. He is the most massive human being I've looked at in quite some time.
We all swipe right on the process of what it took to get her pregnant.
Yes.
Like, we all swipe right on that.
Yes.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. Speaking of which, swipe right, swipe left, J-Lo and Ben Affleck being engaged again. The early aughts are absolutely bad.
Swipe right.
It is a wild time. It is like, it's so weird to have this nostalgia for this time when we were just a little bit younger and a little bit more innocent, but I don't really need J-Lo and Ben Affleck, J-Lack, Ben Lowe.
J-Lack.
I don't really need them in my life. It's not sparking joy for me right now. It can go out with the trash.
I unfortunately am a full proponent of texting your ex back. Like, just of reaching back out to the ex in a way that is toxic and you know is bad for you. Like, I will say do it every single time. And if J-Lo's feeling vulnerable, if she is looking for some self-worth, or if she's looking for something with, like, you know, her ex-lover that she fell out of touch with, like, you know, this makes you happy. Like, go ahead and do it, baby.
I think that's horrible advice. But if I must, I will text my ex after this record for the first time in 4.5 years. I will do it, Fran, for you.
That's one sliding back towards archival dick that I do not recommend. But, you know, this man, Ben Affleck, he has gone to a lot of therapy the last few years. Mm. And I love a redemption narrative.
He's had a lot of career-related turmoil as well.
Yeah, he has. Like, he's a different and a better Ben, I like to think, now than he was then when he made that awful movie with Sandra Bullock, I think. So anyway, I'm here for it. If she's happy, you know what, J-Lo? Get your dick. Be happy. Yeah.
And also, like, if you've seen the gif from Gone Girl where he gets into the shower, he seems to be packing. Mm-hmm. He has a big old dong. And I was like, Okay, Ben.
We have J-Lack and Big Ben. I'm canceling us. No, this is horrible.
Swipe right, swipe left, The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh, I love it.
Oh.
I thought you were going to hate it, Joe.
No, I love it. But we do disagree. We've talked about this, I believe, on the show before. I do disagree that her boyfriend was not the annoying one. She was the annoying one.
You're
a boyfriend apologist.
Oh, this is anti-woman. That's because you resent people's success.
I do resent people's success. That's correct.
And so it makes complete sense that you would have that take.
And I don't think you should break up with your adorable grilled cheese making boyfriend because out of some, like, notion that you're trying to get ahead in a career you didn't even want.
He basically broke up with her. He gave up on her. So, okay.
I mean,
yeah, no, he was trash, both annoying. Except for that grilled cheese he made. That looked delicious.
Wait, that is the take. They are both annoying.
They are both annoying. Yes, I agree.
They're both annoying, but I have never been able to like Adrian Grenier because of that role. Like, ever.
Have you seen his dick pics?
No. Are they out there?
It's not very mighty.
Oh, well.
I think we just need a segment on the show called Teebs Reviews Celebrity Dick Pics.
Oh, no. That would be problematic.
Teebs, what about Kanye's? What about canceled. Kanye's dick pic?
No.
I don't believe I've seen Kanye's.
Does that exist?
He's got an ugly dick.
I think he's like a Ken doll.
Some dicks are pretty and some dicks are ugly, and his is ugly.
Isn't this the Jay-Z of dicks?
Swipe right, swipe left. Can we swipe right, swipe left on blackberries?
Oh my God.
I never had one.
Never had
swipe
one.
Swipe left.
I loved my blackberry. Did y'all have like a razor or like a sidekick?
I had a Nokia that had green screen, and you could play Nibbles on the Nokia.
Oh my God.
And I had that until I had phones like that until like 2012.
I loved my Nokia all throughout high school. And then I got a BlackBerry in college and used that all through college. I did not get an iPhone until it was like, you know, it had already been accepted into the culture. I was still on my BlackBerry shit.
Did the BlackBerry have the internet on it?
Yes, it did, but mostly emails.
We did.
Right.
Yeah.
Like,
I never had that, or I went straight from a flip phone to an iPhone. So, like, I had a flip phone in 2012, y'all.
Yeah, same, baby. Same.
I just listened to, what was it called? You're Wrong About. Their latest episode is all about emails. Ooh. And, like, the proliferation of emails and how they became the scourge of our lives. And the BlackBerry was a defining moment in the history of emails, because prior to that, you had to be at your computer mm-hmm. in order to check your stuff. You couldn't mm-hmm. take your emails with you. Mm-hmm. And that was, like, the watershed moment in the history of why emails are so annoying now.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I can't wait to listen to that episode, Teebs. Our favorite show. Our favorite moving pictures, You're Wrong About. Even though it's not moving pictures. Swipe right, swipe left. Being 20.
Left. Oh, it's horrible.
My 20s were horrible. I peaked in my 20s. This is the greatest years of my life.
Wait, you're not still in your 20s, Fran?
No, I actually will not disclose
baby,
that.
That was a joke. That was entirely a joke. I mean, it's just that you act
Ooh, yeah. I was with someone recently who was just like, how old are you? Like 26? And I was like, you can stay with me. Like, you can stay here. Yeah. Like, you can follow me around, actually.
I got carded and I was like, God bless you.
Yes.
God bless you.
I loved being 20. I was so cute and innocent.
I hated it, but I did look amazing.
Swipe.
Yeah. I hated it and looked terrible. I looked so terrible. I couldn't afford haircuts.
I also looked terrible. One thing that I like about getting older is I am getting hotter. And I'm thankful for that. Swipe right, swipe left. Economic collapse.
Oh my God.
Which, you know, was then in the early 2000s.
Right.
And she's back, baby.
She's back. She's back.
Encouraging economic collapse.
She's back. Yes, I mean, God. I remember the dot-com bubble, 2001. It was actually pre-9/11. 2001 was the dot-com bubble. We lived through so many, you know, then the 2008 subprime housing financial collapse. Mm. It's just capitalism is a hell of a thing with these manufactured crises that then only serve to take more money from the government through the recovery. It's a swipe left for me. It's a swipe left on economic collapse.
Wait, actually, I'm thinking about early aughts culture, and I have to ask, swipe right, swipe left, Napoleon Dynamite.
How
do y'all remember that?
I do. Do you remember
the impermeable, like, gorilla grip that this had on the culture large?
Yes.
It was, I mean, I remember watching it and being like, heterosexuals, man. They really are out here telling on themselves.
Yeah.
Rose and I talked about this on the pod, but Napoleon Dynamite is very famously, was the death of Hot Topic and its relationship to like counterculture. Cause it used to be like a true counterculture, like gay goth store. And then with the influx, this is kind of like the BlackBerry thing, like with the influx of demand for Napoleon Dynamite merch, they pivoted their strategy entirely to just like, doing licensed content.
Wow.
Anyways,
that
concludes our delicious little game.
Yum, 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 yum. It's time we get to the meat of our discussion, the thought process, spelled T-H-O-T.
T-H-O-T.
And this week, I believe Joe's got our patty cakes.
I have the meat. We are talking about the aughts. Decades, like generations, usually only become clear way after. It just takes time to make sense of the living and to look back at the art, the culture, the writing, and what they all say and who we were then. It's hard enough for me to think about the 90s like this. I mean, I remember the entire decade. I remember it turning 1990. And it's like, that to me already feels like it's not that long ago. So the aughts just blows my mind. How is this a thing that was like 20 years ago that we can look back on and think about as a decade? In that decade, I went from being a high school junior to nearly finishing grad school. I lived in Washington and Minnesota and Madagascar and France, and I moved to New York. It was a decade where I became myself. It's so fundamental to who I am that it's hard to even talk about as separate from me becoming an adult human person. But we will try. I have some questions here, but I want to start with a messy one. Thoughties, to begin, what is one mistake you made in the aughts that you would love to undo?
Ooh.
A very like aughts mistake.
A personal mistake or a community-wide cultural mistake?
You can interpret that however your little faggoty brain wants to, baby.
I have a great one.
Yes, tease.
And this was the dude that I let fuck me in freshman year of college. And it was a definite mistake, but he bought me a 40, so I felt like I had to give him something.
Look, those you were the bargaining chips we had.
It's trading a 40 for the fart pocket. It just is like a perfect little trade.
Not the fart pocket.
I was on the edge of 17, okay? I couldn't, and I was too nervous to get a fake ID, so I had to, like, I was like, okay, this, and he was, like, a senior, and
Teebs,
I was like...
Teebs, a collective exchanging goods and services, that's socialism, baby.
That is
so progressive. Come on, give yourself some credit.
So you would take the butt stuff back, but keep the 40.
I would let him take the 40 too, because it's like, I wish I had not had that man's DNA on my body.
Oh. did you in college ever hear of or play the game Edward 40 Hands?
Is that what you would tape 40s to your hands?
Tape two 40s, one to each hand, and you have to drink them before you can take them off. And the trick is to not get too drunk, but also not have to pee because it's a lot of liquid. But it's also very homoerotic because if you do have to pee, someone who's not playing or who has finished has to like unzip your pants and take out your dick and help you be able to pee.
That's hot. Oh my God, that's so hot. Oh no, I'm like... my isolation has made me ridiculously horny. So
like there's like a man incapacitated. Like that's just good for culture.
Yeah. Sure. I would love to do an updated version of Edward 40 Hands where it's like Edward Moët Chandon Hands.
Edward Prosecco Hands. I will absolutely play.
Yeah, Edward Vuv Hands.
Yeah, Vuv. Yeah, Vuv. Get some Vuv, baby. Vuv.
Yes. I do think that the aughts were 40s and my 2020s are Vuv. That's like a metaphor, I think, for what I'm trying to make this decade be.
The other great regret that I have about that decade is drinking liquor from plastic bottles.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about you, Z?
Okay, I'm going to posit that D doesn't have one.
D has never once made a mistake. Yeah. D has no regrets.
Flawless. I am perfection. No, I have, I mean, I kind of have two. I think the biggest sort of they're framed under the idea that like there are things that I wanted to do that I chose not to do because I was too scared to do them. And I wish I had done them. And so one of them is like in high school, there were so many boys who like wanted to hook up with me and make out with me or do even more with me. And I was too scared to like do anything with them
even after
I came out.
Yeah.
I was so scared. I was just convinced that like I would suck their dick and then they would like beat me. And I just was like, and the
valid fear.
Yeah.
Look, valid fear. Valid fear. And then I was like, how will I explain this to my parents? So there was that. And then, you know, by the time I got to college, I knew I was trans and I didn't say anything to anyone. I came very close to it at one point, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I just wish I had started that part of my journey sooner, mm-hmm. even though, you know, I love where I am now and I love everything that's happening and all of that. But like when you know something that basic about yourself for so long and you spend so many years avoiding it, it's just easy to regret having spent that time.
It's hard to frame like past choices often as regret because they still make you who you are. And I mm-hmm. hope that we've all arrived at a place where we at least in some part like love ourselves. And, you know, for me, I've talked about it on the pod before, but I chased my, you know, boyfriend to the college of his choice. And then we immediately broke up. And then I was stuck in the middle of this like cornfield in Indiana at a school that I hated with a bunch of people that I couldn't relate to, with an academic program that I wasn't really getting what I wanted out of it. And, yeah, I regret that a lot. But at the same time, doing so introduced me to the Kinsey Institute and my love for studying like queer and trans people, studying gender and sex. And it also like I think that being isolated and being, you know, one of like 12 queers on a Grindr roll in like mm-hmm. Bloomington, mm-hmm. Indiana, did create a sense of singularity that I think has like fostered my independence and fostered my very deep-rooted sense of, like, for lack of a better way of putting it, like, me against the world. Mm-hmm. I think that really empowers mm-hmm. me sometimes. And I have my mistakes to thank for that.
I feel like...
Yeah. That's beautiful. I love yeah. that.
One thing you said, Fran, about a Grindr role, because I think it was actually in the late aughts that gay hookup sites went from the Adam for Adam... the online to the phone location-based yeah. apps. And that, I mean, talk yeah. about, like, such a huge, profound shift in the way we meet. Because I was meeting a lot of people on the web-based apps.
Right.
Mostly for dates, for hookups. I feel like, speaking of sluttiness in the aughts and Adam for Adam, and my favorite thing, my friends and I in the aughts used to have this noise where it was the Adam for Adam new message noise that was like, broop. And we would be like walking around, and if you saw a cute guy or a guy you thought was gay on the street, you'd go broop, and everyone would be like, who is it? Who is it? I miss that very much. But one thing that I wish I could do, that is obviously impossible because time machines don't exist, is, but I want to go back to 1999 and tell everyone in the world that PrEP is a thing that works and that you don't have to be deathly afraid of HIV every time you do anything, because all through the aughts, I mean, just devastatingly, I was devastatingly afraid of physical intimacy in a way that like really Same. Inhibited my like ability to feel pleasure and to connect with other people and to explore things other than monogamy. I feel like I was in a lot of relationships in the aughts, in part because I felt like being in a relationship was the only way I could have sex without dying of HIV. And it didn't really matter if the relationship was serving me that well or not, but like at least I wasn't going to get HIV and die from having sex.
Yeah.
So just like, and PrEP undid so much of that internalized fear, shame, and stigma in me that like, oh, I can have sex outside of a relationship, not worry about the condom breaking. I can have raw sex. Raw sex is awesome. And being able to have it without the confines of like this heteronormative monogamous relationship. And even then you're like, oh, maybe my partner's cheating on me. Maybe like they're going to bring it home anyway. It just like that whole decade to me is shrouded in like a cloud of horrific, unending fear of seroconverting.
Yeah. I mean, and like, honestly, like getting pumped full of cum is undefeated.
Yeah, yeah.
Undefeated!
Teebs 75 loads. Are you going to do 75 loads, Teebs?
I would love to talk about fear, because I do think that if, you know, if we think about things that define a decade, I do think that a lot of the 2000s were defined by fear, you know? Mm. I think when we think about 9/11, when we think about how we kind of, when you think about the culture wars, you know, and a very insane kind of like right-wing response to like Janet Jackson's boob and like censorship
so
that
true.
Like permeated a lot of that decade. I think that it's, as a culture, like that is like, I think we're coming around to in the, you know, 2010s and now, to like actually looking fear dead in the face and being, you know, completely, completely like, I don't know, you defiant to it, you know? Mm. I think that we are a lot, as a culture, a lot more fearless, like with, you know, bimbo culture right now, or the way we just kind of like champion being chaotic, quote unquote, being messy, you know? Mm. Like, I think we're all less afraid to be ourselves, which has created its own problem.
I feel like it's the aughts was this incohate fear for most Americans. I mean, it was not an incohate fear for fucking Iraqis that we were killing and displacing. But for most Americans, it was like we started to wake up to climate change. You know, Al Gore's pivot to climate change activism. You know, the decade starts with a stolen election. I mean, literally.
That's what I mean. Literally, like we set up the 2000s with a stolen election. Then 9/11, then fucking Katrina, then the financial crisis. I mean, we went through so much in that early part.
And those 2000s, like, everyone was like, well, you're not going to get a job. You're not going to get a job. I remember getting out of college and they're just like, well, you're not going to get a job. Like, there's no jobs right now.
I feel like...
And an entree to Trump, like George W. fucking Bush. Yes. I remember going to every goddamn protest against that man. And when Obama was elected, it did feel like the lifting of a regime.
It did.
And it was like, heck, but like... I was so naive to think that it couldn't get worse.
Yeah, right. And also just Obama created another culture of fear among half this country. You know what I mean?
Like
people, the pendulum always swings back.
And it's like now we're dealing with the fruition of so many of these things that happened in the aughts. It's like now climate change isn't like an incohate fear. It's like affecting us all the time. Like the financial destruction, the wealth increase of the wealthy versus the rest of us that accelerated, you know, it starts under Reagan in large part. It accelerates under Bush. And now we're like, literally no one has jobs or money. We are all fucked. No one's going to be able to retire. It's just like, it has been so relentless for those of us who have been alive for this since the aughts. And it just feels like, you know, the 90s was this weird decade where I think the 90s had a lot of hope. It had like grunge, but like there was this notion that like, even though the politics were fucked and Clinton was fucked, you know, it's like we had a budget surplus at the end of Bill Clinton, right? There was a notion that like something was functional in some way. I don't know what that was, but it was just like this feeling that we had. And then it was just the aughts were just like, fuck, man, like, fuck.
And I think that like if you think about the 70s and 80s as really defined by their many different forms of counterculture and many different forms of kind of like activism and how and what like emerged from movements in the 70s and 80s, it feels like the 90s were kind of had the residue of that. You know, we were still holding on to the last of grunge and to things that kind of like, you know, we wanted to be vocal about. And I think that kind of dissipated more. Well, or rather got very clouded with the emergence of the internet.
Well, it's also like the grunge. The grunge was such a huge musical movement in the 90s. The grunge to like boy band Pipeline.
My God.
Where it's like then the music of the aughts is this like, and I love it. Like I love pop, boy band, saccharine, you know, useless, delicious candy nonsense. But the music of that decade is really, you know, defined by that type of pop music, which is a complete 180 from grunge.
Well, and also like the I think 90s sort of rap and hip hop was so defined by the rivalry between East and West Coast that in the 2000s we saw like the dissolution of that. Right. And then also because of Mariah Carey, the concept of like, I mean, that still carries out today of having rap features on your pop song.
Yes, 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 yes. And the rise also in the aughts of Southern hip hop, you know, that the geography of American hip hop just shifts a little bit. That's so true.
I mean, I feel like all the big hits in the early aughts were Southern hip hop.
It was a
like
lot.
Like Nelly and shit like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of queerness, or rather, maybe I shouldn't say queerness. I will say a lot of gayness was defined by pop culture in the early aughts. You know, like I think when we think of like Britney, or when we think of like the pop stars that kind of like emerged, I feel like every single conversation revolved around
tabloid culture or like Tiger Beat culture. You know what I mean?
And the stranglehold that paparazzis had on, because it's such a major thing. I mean, before Instagram, like Instagram means that these celebrities get to take their own pictures themselves. So like having to, like selling them is worthless.
Yeah.
So, but before that, you know, our only access to these people was through the medium of paparazzis, right. And they just kind of like went out of control. I mean, like I remember, but I feel implicated in that because I gladly took in these images, like
right,
of like the you know, Lindsay Lohan passed out, or like, you know, Paris Hilton doing coke, or like Amy Winehouse falling out of off stage or something like that. And, but like, I think we were all with this, what this time today is teaching us with, you know, the Amy documentary and with like the Britney Spears stuff is how, complicit we were in the downfall of these women.
And how dark it was, like how dark it was for them personally, how our consumption of them was like a chokehold on them as well. Yeah, totally.
And I remember too, through the Janet and the nip slip, which thank you for bringing that up, friend, because it slipped my mind. But like the hypocrisy of having a sport where grown men are throwing themselves violently at each other and getting concussed and killing themselves, but you can't handle a nipple?
Yeah,
like that whole thing about like that exactly. The United States is so invested in violence and so scared of sex.
It's I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, because this is just coming to my head through the convo, but the aughts is also the decade where reality TV becomes a major component of American entertainment, right? Because you had The Real World and Road Rules in the 90s.
Yeah.
But it's really the aughts where it becomes like such a huge culture. You know,
it definitely mushroomed.
I was watching the first season of Top Chef, for example, which, like, by the way, Padma Lakshmi is not the host of the first season of Top Chef. It is this woman who was Billy Joel's wife at the time, and she is horrible. And it's all the like low rise bootcut jeans and these outfits. I mean, it is like, you feel like literally to watch this, I think it was 2006, the first season of Top Chef, you feel like it was a million fucking years ago. I mean, it feels like the 70s or something. And you're like, that's not even 20 years ago. It feels like reality TV has come so far since then. It feels completely alien. But I think what we're talking about here is this quest to get inside of private lives. Teebs, you're talking about, you know, it's sort of before social media. You're talking about the paparazzi and like the way in which we want to consume the inside lives of celebrities.
Right. Before social media, but like at the cusp of the internet.
That's right. So Facebook probably was around, but Facebook had a very different role at that time. You know, and then you have reality TV come around, which promises at least an inside look at the lives of people, including sometimes celebrities, but often not, but often the rich and wealthy that we never have access to. So I think like it's a decade where we're starting to question like what privacy is, what it means to have access, what it means to have wealth. And then we're all, like you're saying, Teebs, we were all complicit in the consumption of that. And like that stuff mushroomed for a reason, because we fucking ate it up. Like we ate that shit up.
But it started off, I think, a little more, I just remember anyway, like the reality television boom started a little more aspirational in the sense that I think what we first got were contests, like American Idol was 2002,
where they
were like competitive reality television shows, or it was like, well, there's some merit in this because there is some skill being deployed. But then you had something like Laguna Beach and The Hills, which morphed into The Real Housewives, you know, like that kind of stuff, where it's just like these like snotty rich kids that was like, I remember thinking like, what's the incentive to watch this? Because at least with like American Idol, you can sometimes hear really great singers, or Top Chef, people really good at their craft, or like what the art, all the other ones, at least there was some demonstrable pull other than just straight up, I don't know, like idol worship.
But I think that's the thing, is I don't think I understood. I also similarly did not understand reality TV. I didn't get the appeal. But I think it's because I didn't really understand idol worship. You know what I mean? I think as I get, I love reality TV now, and I think that I have like a new kind of relationship to cultural objects that I quote unquote worship. That I think is like, that I like to intellectualize, or that like moves me to think deeper about things that probably have nothing to do with that idol or celebrity, you know?
I have to say, I loved The Hills. It's like so out of character. I don't know why.
That's crazy.
I know.
That's so crazy to me.
I think I liked, first of all, there wasn't that much like it at the time. They were all vapid and horrible. And I thought it was doing an interesting thing with what was real and what was not. I thought it was kind of like meta and a little like it was so obviously produced. Like, it kind of, like, was very obviously scripted, but claimed to be reality. And isn't it the one where the last episode, they are on a set, actually, and they, like, take the set apart and, like, walk away?
Yes, yeah, very meta. How very meta.
You know, I at that time, I was like, this is kind of interesting. I thought it was interesting, and I liked that Heidi was dating that Spencer guy who has my color hair, and that his when he grew a beard out, his beard was the color of his everything, so you couldn't see it. It just made his face look fuzzy. Mm-hmm. I got off on it for whatever reason.
I have a question for the group. Okay, my friend Caleb recently tweeted something very funny. He said, you've probably seen this, it was circulating everywhere. He said, when gay boys turn 13 years old, the universe assigns them one woman working in entertainment. From that point forward, their purpose on Earth becomes supporting this woman so hard that the force of their love could literally kill them. I'm wondering who that person was for y'all in the early aughts. Like, who did you have, like, what early aughts icon? And if not like an icon, it could be like a TV personality or like an author or something like that. Like, who were you like, I would die for them?
Okay, so mine actually started in 98.
Okay.
But it was like this girl in my class who I wanted to be besties with was really into the band Hole. And with Courtney Love as the lead singer. And that was the year that Celebrity Skin came out. So I got the album and I listened to it and I was like this. And then that cool girl will be your friend. And she was like, she was like a riot girl. You know what I mean? Like, she made zines and she was just like, went to punk shows. And I was like, I want her to like me so bad. So I listened to Hole, but then I really liked it. And I really liked Courtney Love as like this really messy person who keeps like falling off the wagon and only has like, she has like the triumph and yes. then the fall always. That's like what her cultural narrative is. And it outstripped her talent and the band and the music, which was fantastic. I mean, like, Celebrity Skin was great, but like, if you go back to Live Through This and Pretty on the Inside, like, there's such great groundbreaking albums and she charted her own type of sound. And I was like, I will die for you.
Yeah. She's like the definition of, we're all rooting for you. We are rooting for you.
Who is yours, Dan?
Come on now.
Michelle Kwan.
Mine was Michelle Kwan.
Of course it was.
Like, obviously, all I cared about was Michelle Kwan. She was my idol. And I would tell people once I came out, I was like, because Michelle Kwan's 5 or 6 years older than me, I would go straight for Michelle Kwan, which of course, I mean, obviously I wouldn't. I didn't say I had a crush on her. I just loved her so much that I was like, I would go straight for Michelle Kwan. Like, I was obsessed with her. And you know, at that time, figure skating was like a super, super, super popular sport, like overall in America, like during the Olympics. And so she felt like this really like major icon. You would see her at things like the Teen Choice Awards and you would see her on the Today Show. And she just was like, you know, they joked about her on Will and Grace several times. So to me, she was this pop icon. And she's really the only one because I've thought about it and I couldn't. One of the ways in which I feel like I was an outlier for that time is that I just couldn't engage in the same way. Like, I did like American Idol because that was so aspirational, but like, and I liked Christina Aguilera, I liked Beyonce, but I wasn't so invested in anyone in that realm that like that tweet, I was like, that almost doesn't apply to me, even though it should. And then I was like, it does apply. It's just Michelle Kwan. But I don't know. I just felt very much like it was so separate that it had nothing to do with me and my life and what I was trying to accomplish.
I'm a bisexual, so the tweet does not apply to me. Bisexuals get it when we're 30, and mine is Donna Haraway. I would die for you, Donna Haraway.
Shut the fuck up, you cyborg. I will not. I don't know. I think mine I feel like my love for Beyonce didn't really emerge like full force until the 2010s. It definitely started with Destiny Fulfilled in the aughts, but like, I think it was Lindsay Lohan. I really consumed everything she did. I monitored press about her. I went to every movie, listened to every song she released. Like, I think it really was Lindsay Lohan. And I'm not quite sure. Like, I really loved Parent Trap as a kid. And I think the Nancy Meyers cinematic universe is the real star of my childhood. But, like, I think I didn't understand that. And therefore, Lilo became the chalice for all of my love.
Well, she did have, like, an incredible amount of goodwill, cultural goodwill, coming out of Mean Girls. Because, like, that was such a hit. And I remember, like, she, like, before the fall, you know, but she, where she was still, like, sort of wholesome, and she lived with Raven Simone. They were roommates, and they were, like, Disney Channel buddies. And then you kind of saw her slowly, you know, go into the Paris Hilton world, and then it was just like, then you would see like videos of her like trying on sunglasses, obviously baked and coked out of her mind, like, and it was just like, oh man, we were rooting for you.
Yeah,
we were all rooting for you.
I would say
my other one came out of 2002, because that was my senior year of high school, and that was the year that Kelly Clarkson won American Idol, and I was just like, this person's voice is absolutely fantastic. Like, it was like when you saw somebody who emerged out of the tradition of, you know, the big voice like Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston, and then land on this like small girl from Texas who just like absolutely destroyed every week. And I had like the first album, and then fucking the second album came out, which was Breakaway, which had Since You've Been Gone and all that stuff. And she was like bona fide pop star after that.
And she had the it factor. It separated her from any other like American Idol contestant. You know, to me, the only stars to emerge from that show are her and Jennifer Hudson, who didn't even win. And like, it tells you that like, obviously they're unparalleled vocal talents, but like, the voice will only get you so far. You have to have that star quality.
And no one else has ascended to that level. And I thought it was so interesting that Kelly Clarkson was the first, you know, won the first season of American Idol. And even then, I was like, I was like, do you think they'll ever have another winner who's as good as her? I didn't know. And for me, I thought that that meant that reality TV, by the way, I'll say, would only last for like, I was like, max 10 years. Like, America will get bored of this. That's what I legitimately thought. I was like, by the time I finished college, America, like all reality TV is going to be on its way out. Obviously, I was wrong. But two fun facts about those things. Like, my love for Beyonce goes all the way back to Bills, Bills, Bills. And you know who wrote that song? Candy Burris of the Real Housewives of Atlanta.
I forgot actually wrote that song. Candy.
Yeah. Candy, who really is like a huge purveyor of pop culture, but behind the scenes because she wrote so much. And my factoid about Kelly Clarkson is just that I sang a Kelly Clarkson song to get into my a cappella group in college.
Oh my God.
Of course. Will you offer which song?
It was a ballad from that second album. I can't remember the name of it right now, but...
Was it Breakaway?
No.
Was it from the Princess Diaries soundtrack?
Breakaway.
No, but that is something that I would have done. It's from the same album that had Since You've Been Gone, the second album.
Mm-hmm.
I'll look it up.
This is just bringing me back to when Den was shit-faced singing in the back of the car on a Food for Thought drive in like a rural New Hampshire.
Period.
You know, we've all heard the story, Joe. It was because of you. It was that song.
I have an ending question, and it actually brings me back to one of the things on the swipe list that we didn't have time for, which is Jose Esteban Munoz's Cruising Utopia, which came out in the aughts. And I feel like it's such a foundational book for queer theory, particularly not white queer theory, that it feels like it's been around for 60 years, but it hasn't. It's been around for way less than 20. It came out in like 2009, I think. But he, in that book, talks a lot about straight time and how queers resist straight time. And like, straight time is sort of like, you're born, you have first communion, you go to college, you get married, you have kids, you retire out of sight and die, blah, 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 blah. And so just thinking about the ways in which like time is such a dumb construct, what is the meaning of a decade? Like, it's such an arbitrary, stupid, it's like, oh, every 10 years, we're going to call this a cultural artifact. And it has like brackets and, you know, it's like 2000 to 2010 is a thing. Like, is it a thing? Is a decade a thing?
I mean, we could have a whole other episode on existentiality because, you know, why do humans make meaning out of literally anything? You know, like, why do we have generations? Why do we have names? You know what I mean? Like, it's there's so much that we could dissect. I feel like, to me, when we try to make meaning out of the world, particularly like when we say, oh, this ends and starts the decade, I think we're just trying to like not go insane. You know,
I agree.
Like, yeah. The void is a 100%. Cold place. I don't want to look in there all the time. Yeah. But you know, just from being like a base 10 numerical system, like that's where the meaning starts and stops.
Yeah. So it's math. What you're saying is it's math, and it's, math is notoriously homophobic. So what you're saying is decades are homophobic.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Except for Janet Jackson's album Designer of a Decade.
Period.
I'm full, but I could fit one more thing inside of me. Dead knows how I feel.
A fist. No, not friend, that. Not that.
Friend, why don't you pop the cherry on this top?
Listen, we have to talk about it because everyone's talking about it, and everyone's talking about it for a reason. The movie Everything Everywhere All at Once, starring Michelle Yeoh, is
mind-blowing.
It is absolutely worth the hype. It exceeded my already impossibly high expectations based on like social sentiment and like reviews that had been out. Like, this is a once in a generation, not a once in a generation movie. Once in a decade movie, even. I could say that. Like, I don't know if I've seen a movie like this in the decade, within a decade. You know what I mean?
One that's so incredibly sets up its Michelle Yeoh, the actress, for success. I mean, especially like for an older woman in general, but especially for an older woman to get to do all of the things that she does in this movie. I mean, she's talked about it and cried about it, which made me cry about it, which is that like the script was unlike anything she'd ever read before and got, and allowed her to be like all versions of herself.
And it's like, it's such an actor's dream project too. But like, you know, for the people out there that haven't heard about it yet, the log line is like, that there, Michelle Yeoh is a woman who owns a coin laundromat with her family. She has like a pretty, you know, a pretty tedious and like even like boring, mediocre life. And while she's getting audited, she discovers that she is a part of a multiverse of which she is like the sole savior. And she's like the only one that can basically like rescue the universe from this impending doom, rescue the multiverse rather from this impending doom. And, you know, no spoilers, but the film like does allow Michelle Yeoh to inhabit many, many, many different selves. And I think that when it comes to actors of color, when it comes to like women, when it comes to a woman like Michelle Yeoh, we really don't give them roles that have any meat at all. And Michelle Yeoh, despite that, at least in American cinema, has proven herself despite getting somewhat shallow roles. Like, she's always like gonna be this kind of fierce woman, maybe with a sword, maybe like she's like a cold mom. And those roles have proven how talented she is, but they haven't shown the full roundedness of her. And the interesting thing about Everything Everywhere All at Once is that the main character is thousands and thousands of women in this country. It is like one of the most common stories when it comes to immigrants and how they make a living here and the kind of the forever sadness that you have about whether or not you made the right choice to come to America. What they take is an extremely average story and they explode it and make the most interesting, like, thoughtful, vivid, multiplicity of perspective kind of story you've ever seen. Oh, it's so good.
It's so good. I mean, it's emotional and absurd. It's very absurd. Funny and it's dramatic. Like, it has all quadrants of the multiverse in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ultimately, it's at the heart of it, a relationship. And you know, you just kind of watch this person's esteem for themselves and for their family grow. And, you know, what their bottom line ends up being. And it's just a wonderful, like, it's like, it's almost like it doesn't take itself too seriously, but it's also deadly serious.
Yes, mm-hmm. It is. Mm-hmm. And the movie's cameos also. I mean, all of the performances of the family are incredible. And also the cameos from Jamie Lee Curtis and Jenny Slate are like, there's nothing, I don't want to spoil. It's just like, they're unreal. Like, you would never in a million years. Basically, when you watch the film, within the first 10 to 15 minutes, you're like, oh, I think I know what kind of movie this is. And then the movie just absolutely, nothing after that, those first 10 to 15 minutes can be predicted. Nothing. Not one single thing.
I was delighted. And I'm not going to spoil it because this isn't going to mean anything, but Jenny and that dog.
Jenny and that dog.
Teams, you want to spoil it so bad. You want to spoil it so
actually,
bad.
No spoilers, but Jamie Lee Curtis and those hot dogs. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh my God. Oh God. Also, when she's like, did you staple something to my forehead?
Oh my God. Y'all have to see it immediately. And everyone listening to this podcast, go see it in theaters. You need to see it in theaters. It is very unfortunate that a movie like this took years and years and years to make, because Hollywood fundamentally doesn't believe in movies like this. And a lot of that is a consequence of films led by people of color that flop in the theaters. And then they say, oh, well, no more movies for people of color. Like, we're not going to do that again. Like, I just rewatched The Wiz, and like, you know, that was like kind of that story of like marketing the end of like blaxploitation films of that era. And we have to support this movie. And I'm not one of those girls that is always just like, we need to support movies. Let's go to the, you know what I mean? Like, but you have to buy a ticket.
It was excellent.
Oh, let us know what you think, thoughts.
Spicy.
And there's queer stuff.
Oh yeah,
a lot of queer stuff.
There's a lot of hot dogs. This episode of Food for Thought is made possible by the generous, unequivocal support of Rosé and our new home at Stitcher. Our producer is the pasta to our fagioli, Alexandra De Palma.
I hate you.
Subscribe, rate, and review us 5 stars on iTunes, or we make Joe fart into a jar and then we mail it to you. My name is Tommy...
Fart Pocket.
My name is Tommy Teebs Pico. You can find me at Hey Teebs.
You're fired.
HEYTEEBS on Instagram. And also, LA come out this weekend for the LA Times Book Fest, which I will be featuring at.
That's amazing, Teebs. I'm Joseph Osmondson. You can find me at www.josephosmondson.com, where you can find a link to pre-order my book. There's all sorts of exciting news happening with it that I can't share, but it's really exciting, and I would so appreciate your support.
I'm Fran. You can find me at Fran Squishco, and I also have something to promote for the Los Angeles Thoughts. I'm hosting a party called Gorgeous Gorgeous for a lot of queer and trans NBs here in LA, and you can find info for that on my Instagram bio if you want. I'd love to see you there. Let's come out and say hi.
Ooh, and I'm Den Michelle Norris, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at the Den Michelle.
Oh, you can find us at Gay Sluts Who Read and join us on Facebook and Twitter at Food for Thought Pod. And finally, send your questions, thoughts, concerns, and dick pics to thoughts at foodforthoughtpodcast.com. As always, that's food, the number 4, and thought spelled how?
T-H-O-T.
Bye.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.